Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and despite everything in the news these days, Middle East expert and University of Michigan historian Juan Cole is optimistic about the future of democracy in the region. His new book is called The New Arabs, How the Millennial Generation is Changing the Middle East. Professor Cole, welcome back to WNYC.
Thanks so much, Brian.
Can I start with that premise? Are you more optimistic about democracy in the Arab world right now than most Americans who casually follow the news?
Oh, absolutely. I think it is not appreciated often how young these people were who made all that trouble in 2011 and after.
In Tahrir Square and
Tahrir all of that? Square and in similar places in Tunisia and elsewhere. They're 20, 21, and some of them, you know, the older of them were 32. So sometimes people ask me, well, why didn't, you know, they run for election and get elected to parliament and become prime minister? And, you know, in most countries, they're too young to play that kind of role. And it'll be 20, 30 years before these people, you know, come to power politically.
But are there enough of them? I mean, if you're going to frame in broad generational terms, millennials come from all the different backgrounds, and they probably want lots of different things, depending if they're urban or rural, educated or less educated, Sunni or Shia. Does something unite the generation across these lines?
Yes. Well, first of all, it is true. They're all kinds of people and very diverse, but less diverse than their parents. So, you know, most of them are urban. Most of them are highly literate. Most of them are fairly wired and hooked in with international media. Many of them have lived abroad and worked abroad. So the ones who have been active and who have formed organizations on the basis of being youth.
And yet we see, to stay with Egypt as an example for the moment, that the wild gonims of the world, you know, the kind of Western-leaning, real pluralism and democracy advocates have been pushed aside, first by the Islamists with the rise of Morsi and now by the military. So they don't have that much of a constituency.
Well, what I would argue is that because they were so young, what they did really was to insist that there not be hereditary dictatorships. And they pulled those down. And you know, the Mubaraks, Zainuddin bin Ali in Tunisia, the Gaddafis in Libya, these people were family cartels, and they were planning just to stay there. The next generation would come to power. And the young people just said, that's not acceptable. That's not going to happen. And they have derailed that entire project in most of the Arab world. But they opened the way for elections, and they're too young to stand for office, and mostly they're not very interested in traditional political parties. So it was the baby boomers who came to power. It was people who were 60, and they are still governed by, you know, their generation's values and ideals. Mostly they were split into kind of pro-military nationalists on the one hand and devotees of political Islam on the other. What I'm saying is that the 20-somethings are not attracted very much by either one, and you can see it this year in Egypt, for instance. They didn't come out to vote on either of the big occasions, the constitutional revolution or the presidential election.
The young people didn't like their choices.
They didn't like their choices. And what I would argue is that it's the older generation's food fights that we're now seeing. The young people are biding their time.
Your book is called The New Arabs, but ISIS is not in the index. Are they an even newer kind of new Arab?
Well, my book is about youth movements and civil youth movements.
But who's in something like ISIS? Is it not also young people as well as some older people?
Well, terrorist groups and those kinds of violent guerrilla organizations are the death of civil society and civil organizations. And so I would argue that, you know, there may be some people in the Arab world who might have joined a civil organization if that path had been open to them, but were radicalized by, say, the Syrian dictatorship and took up arms. But for the most part, no, I would say that the people who are supporting a group like ISIS are not very much like the Tahrir crowd. The young people in the crowds in Tahrir, as I said, they were urban. They were disproportionately well educated. They were wired. They were literate. A lot of these people in ISIS are much more rural, and they've had success in rural Syria and in very small town Syria. A lot of them are not very well educated. They don't have much prospects and so forth. So I would say yes, probably they're not the same people I'm talking about.
So partly, this optimism comes from some faith that the educated elite who are young in these countries will come to influence the direction of society more than others.
Well, not just the elite, though. What I'm saying is that if you look at the some 40% of the Arab world that was born between the late 70s and the year 2000, most of them are fairly well educated. Most of them are fairly literate, and most of them, you know, have an awareness of the world. So these kind of rural backwoods fundamentalists that we see in northern Syria or in northern Iraq are not just not representative of that generation.
Juan Cole, historian from the University of Michigan and Middle East expert, my guest on WNYC. His new book is The New Arabs, How the Millennial Generation is Changing the Middle East. Let me get your take on some of the things that are going on in the news right now. You've been on here, on PBS, elsewhere many times to comment on Iraq over the years, and you're a long-time skeptic about U.S. intervention in the region, an early opponent of the Iraq War before the war. What role do you see for the United States ideally in the region right now with the current crisis, or how do you see the choices?
The United States is not very relevant to most of the struggles that are going on in the region at the moment. A lot of it is just happening, you know, in neighborhoods and on the ground. It's not high politics. It's not something geopolitical. So, you know, there are people who argue that the Obama administration shouldn't have allowed Hosni Mubarak to fall, for instance. I don't see what choice they had. You know, if you have millions of people in the street every day, it paralyzes the country. The president can't stay after a while. So this idea that the U.S. can shape the region powerfully, I think, really has to be given up. And even where they, you know, occupied Iraq for 8 years and tried to shape it, well, how's that working out for them? So I don't think it's at that level that the United States can intervene.
But people like John McCain will say, we did shape it when the surge after 2006 started to have some successes, and then we walked away from it, which is why this is happening now. And I want to get your take on a piece or two of that, because one of the biggest controversies in this debate is whether President Obama could have won immunity from local prosecution for a residual U.S. force there after 2011, allowing 10 or 20,000 troops to stay and possibly staving off the current ISIS threat. Some Republicans, as you know, say the president just wanted to get out. He was a withdrawal totally from Iraq guy, didn't really want to strike a deal. Do you think Iraq was interested in that kind of deal for some U.S. troops to have remained?
Well, there were Iraqis who were interested in having U.S. troops remain. The Kurds would have liked that, but they are a minority. And some of the politicians like Ayatollah Alawi would have supported it. But the vast majority of Iraqis and, more importantly, of Iraqi parliamentarians simply would not have voted for such a thing. And this was clear when the Bush administration in 2008 tried to negotiate a status of forces agreement with the Iraqi parliament. It was determined by the Bush administration, by the way, that they couldn't just have the prime minister sign off on this. They needed to get the parliament to sign off.
Why would the parliament, which presumably is majority Shiite, which is now the target of ISIS, more or less, why wouldn't they have wanted a residual U.S. force?
Well, they didn't like being occupied by U.S. troops. They, after Abu Ghraib, remember all those pictures that came out about U.S. troops setting dogs on people and torturing them and making them naked? They thought we were perverts. In the U.S. had 25,000 Iraqis in its prisons in Iraq. About a third of them were Shiite. It fought militias. I think Americans just have this odd idea that we're liked, and we weren't liked in Iraq, and they didn't want us there, and they certainly weren't going to invite us to stay.
Do you think that kind of residual force would have presented the current rise of ISIS to its current level?
No. I mean, I don't see how if you had left 5,000 U.S. troops in Iraq, they'd be on some base in Baghdad or something. What could they do about neighborhoods in Mosul rising up against the al-Maliki army?
Nothing.
This is part of my whole message in this book also, is that these are social movements. They're happening in neighborhoods. They're happening in back alleys. The U.S. just doesn't have the levers of power at that micro level to shape those developments.
So maybe with your understanding of the region, you can give our listeners a little background on this Sunni-Shiite divide that they hear about all the time. And is coming to the fore again. What's it really about at this point? Is it a theological difference from over 1,000 years ago? Or is it more about current states of inequality and things like that that happen to run along those lines?
Sure. I mean, there is a religious difference, but I don't think anybody's fighting over, interpretations of theology. As like in Northern Ireland, it's a matter of some communities feeling neglected by the government or having a different political ideology than the government wants them to have, not getting social services and so forth. The Sunni Arabs in Iraq had been on top. They were the elite of the country, and they were demoted by the Shiites, and so they're protesting.
One development today, and really this has been going on for a little while now, but Ahmed Chalabi seems to be back in the political mix, the aging exiled dissident leader from the Saddam Hussein days, who seemed pro-democracy but fed Americans that bad information about Saddam's alleged WMDs that didn't exist when he wanted the invasion. Why Ahmed Chalabi again, and could he yet become a force for good?
I'd be shocked and amazed if Ahmed Chalabi amounted to anything in this process. First of all, this thing that happened with the Sunni Arabs was partly his fault. He was the one who fired them all from their government jobs and brought in his Shiite cronies to replace them.
In the earliest days of the U.S. occupation,
yes.
When he was a top advisor.
Yes. It was something called de-Bathification. If you'd been a member of the Ba'ath Party, he thought that you shouldn't be able to keep your government job. And this included like high school teachers and so forth. So he caused a lot of the problems. He's never he couldn't win a seat in parliament. He's never been popular enough to do that. So how he would become prime minister, I don't know.
So we'll see how long the Ahmed Chalabi media boomlet lasts. And let's hope your optimism about the millennials and what they will bring to the region is founded. Juan Cole from the University of Michigan, his new book, The New Arabs, How the Millennial Generation is Changing the Middle East. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Up next, the author James Patterson on one book he wants sixth graders to read and why he worries that Amazon is killing literature. Stay with us.